Well, thank you for coming. What I'm going to present today, I won't take too long because I'm really interested to hear what Rob has to say on this issue, but it's really based on a paper that I wrote with Fiona de Londres, also of UCD, in the American Journal of Comparative Law, and that was published in 2010. So I'm really going to update this paper, of course, as well in today's session, but I'm more or less setting out similar arguments to those that we set out in that paper. Okay, so what was at issue in CADI? Before we get into the facts of the case, again, many of you will be familiar with the facts, but certainly we saw the issue fundamentally at stake in CADI being the conflict between rights, obligations of states and regional organisations, international organisations, and security obligations of the same. And one of the really interesting features of this area is the way that all of these obligations are conflicting but also overlapping at the international, regional and national levels. So that's why this area is so complex. So what I'm going to do today is just go briefly into the different approaches that can be taken to this conflict as we divided it, as we categorised it and argued for in our article. In European courts in particular, not only the EU's courts, but also the Strasbourg Court, the European Court of Human Rights, and also we looked at the courts of the UK, of France and Germany. So it was a kind of comparative piece we did. And then at that point, I'll look at how the Court of First Instance, now called the General Court, in the EU legal system, dealt with the CADI case in particular, and then how that was dealt with on appeal by the European Court of Justice, which is the highest court in the EU. And I'll kind of finish off by asking this big question, which I think has become quite a commonly held view, I would say, in certain areas at least, certain areas of the globe, I would say, that CADI should be read as meaning that the EU doesn't really believe in international law anymore, or doesn't really take international law seriously. That view, as we see, has been put forward by a variety of commentators, very eminent commentators, such as Posner, Jack Goldsmith, and Gronje de Burka, amongst others. I do not agree with that view at all, and I'll go into the reasons for that later on. All right, so very briefly then, the facts at stake in CADI. CADI concerned an action being brought by Mr. CADI, who is a Saudi Arabian national, who was is a very wealthy businessman with lots of assets in Europe. And he brought an action to annul a regulation of the EU Council of 2002, which implemented a UN Security Council resolution and which put him on a blacklist, which meant his assets had to be frozen. I think most of you know the context of CADI anyway. The UN Security Council asset freezing resolutions were part of a group of resolutions whereby the UN Security Council was taking this economic approach of implementing what we call smart sanctions to get at terrorist financing via the freezing of assets. Okay, I think we're kind of familiar with that. However, Mr. CADI's problem in particular, amongst others, he made a variety of arguments in the EU courts, but his particular problem, which is of interest for us for today's session, is that he made human rights arguments saying that he hadn't had a right to be heard in the context of the formation of this blacklist, and he hadn't received any reasons for his being placed on the blacklist. Okay. So, just let's break down, I think it's useful to break down how the UN Security Council resolutions are implemented at EU level, because it's not always obvious. It is quite complex. Even to EU lawyers, we kind of sometimes get a little bit confused at the different types of implementation. So here in the CADI case, we have the UN Security Council resolutions, of course, which create the asset freezing regime. We also then have the next level of implementation at UN level of the Security Council resolutions, which is the blacklist being drawn up itself by what's known as the Sanctions Committee, which is a UN body. At EU level, there are two layers of implementation of those kinds of Security Council resolutions. There's what's known as a common position, which is a measure taken by consensus. It's a political measure taken under the EU's common foreign and security policy, which is an intergovernmental pillar of the EU. And in addition to that, alongside that, there's regulations which are used to implement the economic aspects of the UN Security Council resolution. And it was the regulation and the common position that were being challenged in Mr. Cady's case. As we see, only his challenge in relation to the regulation was successful, because the ECJ doesn't have jurisdiction to adjudicate, or didn't at that time have any jurisdiction at all to adjudicate on the legality of common positions. Okay, and then there's a third layer of implementation in the EU, which is implementation by member states. Now, member states can go it alone to implement UN Security Council resolutions if they wish, if they feel that's appropriate, that's perfectly fine. However, in most cases, in these asset freezing cases, member states have chosen to use the EU way of implementing Security Council resolutions, in particular in the case of asset freezing measures, because there's such a close link between asset freezing and free movement of capital, which is one of the big areas of EU internal market law. So that's why we have national implementation of the political common position, of course, but we also have an obligation on the part of member states to ensure the enforcement of the economic part of the EU implementation, the regulation. Okay? Right, so before I go to what Cady held, I want to set out what our typology was, our categorization of how different courts at regional, national, international levels have framed this rights security conflict prior to Cady, and then we'll see what the court did in Cady. And we really divide these kind of framing approaches to framing this conflict into five categories. And I'll go through them now. So the issue that we call them jurisdictional competence, framing as in relation to the source of the measure, deference to the Security Council, primacy of the local legal order, and then finally human rights equivalent. So let's explain what we mean by that right now. So let's start with the first approach then, which we call jurisdictional competence. And this really is very simple. It's where a court says, no, I do not have competence in the first place to look at whether or not the right balance is struck between rights and security. So in other words, the court is saying, we don't even get into the Balancing Act because we don't have jurisdiction to go there. So it's quite a nice way out, if you want to see it like that, for courts who want to take this approach, or you could see it as a cop-out. Depends which way you look at it. This is the approach that the European Court of Human Rights, so the Strasbourg Court, took in the Barami in France case of 2007, which concerned the actions of the UN forces in Kosovo, where they were in charge at that time, and Mr. Barami's children were, well, one child was killed and one child was injured by an unexploded, by a cluster bomb, which then exploded under the control of the Kosovo forces. And Mr. Barami sued France because France had been a member of the Kosovan UN forces at that time, saying that you failed to protect my child's right to life here under Article 2 of the European Convention of Human Rights. And so the European Court of Human Rights had to decide whether or not it had jurisdiction to hear that case. And it said, no, we do not have jurisdiction because this was not an act of France as a member state. This was an act of the UN. So we do not have jurisdiction, ratione personae, over this. And it also declined jurisdiction on the ground that the Act didn't take place within the territory covered by the European Convention on Human Rights because it was in Kosovo, which wasn't territorial within the jurisdiction. So again, this was a decision of the European Court of Human Rights really just not to deal with the whole issue at all, and was criticised by quite a lot of commentators on that basis. Contrast, for instance, the approach of the UK House of Lords in the Al Jeddah case, where it concerned the detention of Mr. Al Jeddah in Iraq for what he said was an unduly long period. And in that case, the UK House of Lords did say that it had jurisdiction to consider the legality of that detention. So that was a positive approach to jurisdiction, even though it was extraterritorial in the same way as Barami. Another way in which jurisdictional competence has been disclaimed by courts has been in the case of the EU courts, where the EU courts have said, we do not have any jurisdiction to review any acts under the Common Foreign and Security Policy. So those are the common positions that I mentioned earlier. There's been a number of cases. The Seggi case is probably the leading one, where the ECJ has said, I'm sorry, we would love to review this. Implicitly in the judgment it says that, but we just do not have any competence to do so under the EU treaties, because the member states deliberately did not give the ECJ any competence at that time to review any measures under the Common Foreign Security Policy of the EU. So it was a complete jurisdictional vacuum there. Now the Treaty of Lisbon, which is the most recent treaty of the EU, which came into force in December 2009, that changes matters quite positively here. Article 275 of the treaty gives the ECJ for the first time jurisdiction over measures that would affect individuals, even if taken under the Common Foreign Security Policy. So that's changed matters here. All right. So let's move on then to our second approach in terms of framing this rights security conflict. And this is where the court really focuses on the source of the measure that's being attacked here. Is it coming from the UN? Is it coming from the local legal order? In which case it may be more amenable to review. And we see this in quite a lot of cases where the courts have said, as long as we can say there's some kind of discretion at local level in implementing a UN Security Council resolution, then that's enough of a hook for us to say we have jurisdiction to review the national implementing measure. So we see it in a number of cases of the EU courts, PMOI, CESAN, OCALAN, where the EU's level of discretion in implementing UN Security Council resolutions was seen as being quite substantial. In particular, the blacklist in those cases was not being drawn up at UN level, it was being drawn up at EU level. So there was quite a bit of discretion there as to who was on the blacklist. And in those cases, the European courts have said, yes, we will review these implementing measures for compliance with human rights. And there was no outcry in those cases because it was clear that it was not a direct challenge to the Security Council resolution as such. We also see it in the case in the French courts, which is quite interesting, the Conseil d'État in the leading case, Association Secours Mondial, where the French court in that case looked at the extent to which the domestic measures really were necessitated by the UN resolution, and in that case made a very specific distinction between the part of the domestic implementing measures that was necessitated by the international act and that part that wasn't and could be severed from the international act. In contrast, where in those cases where there's the measure is really being compelled by the Security Council resolution, many courts have chosen to adopt a deliberately less intensive standard of review if they go ahead to review the Act at all. And again, the Al Jeddah case is a good example here, the leading case from the UK, as it was then House of Lords, it's now the Supreme Court. where the House of Lords famously espoused this doctrine of minimal interference with human rights. So if the UK is implementing a Security Council resolution, it should do so in a way that interferes to the least extent possible with the rights at issue. But as long as the UK does that, then the UK House of Lords said, we're not going to interfere with that anymore. We're not going to judicially review it anymore. And the UK Court of Appeal, in a further case, adopted a similar approach. And we also have this kind of approach, interestingly, from the European Court of Justice itself in a case called Bosphorus, which was about the implementation of a UN Security Council resolution in the context of the Yugoslav war. In that case, an aircraft had been leased to a third party from the Yugoslav government. And the aircraft was then impounded by the Irish authorities, actually, because they happened to land it in Ireland. This was in implementation of an EU regulation that in turn implemented the UN Security Council resolution requiring them to do this. So when the EU regulation was challenged before the EU courts, the ECJ said, well, we can look at the legality of this regulation, but actually we, on balance, find that it's okay and it's in compliance with rights, with the human rights doctrine under the EU, because of the obvious need to ensure international security that was the purpose of the measures in relation to the Yugoslav regime at that time. So again, we see this this less intensive standard of review, even in a case where there is some review for compliance with rights. All right, so let's move on to our third approach then, which we call deference, which is basically the kind of high watermark, I suppose, of really not wanting to touch an issue at all, where the court basically says that we're not going to review a measure that flows from the UN Security Council resolution. Or it can, in some cases, the courts have done it on the basis that it's because of the subject matter at issue, it's too closely related to national defence, so we're not going to review it on that basis. The first category, where you know we have this deference to the UN Security Council as such, is obvious in a number of cases. The Bahrami case is a good example, although in that case, as we said, the court actually decided it on jurisdiction. So what they said in relation to deference was obiter, but nonetheless quite interesting. The Court of First Instance, which is now the General Court in Cardi, very much took this approach, and we'll look at the Court of First Instance's judgment in a minute. We have this approach also from the Swiss Federal Supreme Court in the NADA case, which is currently before the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, which will be quite interesting to see how Strasbourg decides that. But the Swiss court said, basically, we're not going to go there because this national implementing measure flows from the UN Security Council resolution. And in terms of subject matter deference, well, again, the French Conseil d'État decision in Association Secours is quite a good example, where the Conseil d'État said, we will look at it in principle. We're not going to say we're not going to look at this implementing measure simply because it flows from a UN Security Council resolution, but we're not going to judicially review it here because it's too closely related to national defence. So on that basis, so national law basis, really, the Conseil d'État declined jurisdiction to get really involved. All right, so if you go to the other extreme, then there are some cases where courts have said essentially that we are only going to apply our local legal order here. We're going to review every international implementing measure, it doesn't matter where it comes from, for compliance with our own local standards of human rights or other national law standards. Now, Some people would say the ECJ's Caddy case falls into this category. I would not agree with that. But certainly other cases that commentators would see as falling into this kind of approach would be, for instance, the decision of the US Supreme Court in the Medallen case, where the Supreme Court declined to follow a judgment of the International Court of Justice, finding that it was not the judgment was not binding on it as such, preferred to just look at the laws that were applicable in the U.S. legal order as such. Okay. Right, so our final approach then in categorising the way courts frame this conflict between rights and security is quite an important one in Europe, at least. It is an approach whereby courts say, in general, we will not review your measure for compliance with our own rights as long as overall your system, your legal order, attains a satisfactory level of rights protection. Okay, so in other words, there's a balancing process undergone by the court that looks at whether or not the other legal system overall attains an equivalent level of human rights protection as the domestic legal system. And we have this approach very clearly in the Bosphorus decision when it went to the European Court of Human Rights, so the Strasbourg Court, which dealt with the issue after the European Court of Justice had dealt with it. In that case, the European Court of Human Rights was being asked whether the EU's legal system overall attained an equivalent level of rights protection as the Strasbourg system, the European Convention of Human Rights. And in that case, the European Court of Human Rights said, yes, it does. And for that reason, we're not going to review EU measures for compatibility with the European Convention of Human Rights unless there's a manifest deficiency in the application of rights in a particular case. So that was the Bosphorus case. We also have this approach very famously being espoused by the German Constitutional Court in a variety of cases, and probably the most famous of which is the Solange judgments, where the German Constitutional Court said, well, in Solange 2, that we will not review EU measures for compatibility with the German standards of fundamental rights so long as the EU as a whole is guaranteeing a sufficient level and an equivalent level of rights protection. And at that time, the German Constitutional Court was happy to say that, yes, it is for now, but we will retain our right to make this review if there is any deviation from this in the future. So that's the famous German Constitutional Court stance on this. And this was the approach that the Commission, the European Commission, argued for in Caddy. So the European Commission said, we should not second guess the UN's system of human rights and the balance that the UN Security Council has taken in these resolutions if we are happy that overall the UN system offers an adequate protection of human rights. Now, the ECJ did not agree with that, but that was what the European Commission was arguing. All right, so what did the court hold in Caddy? Let's first of all briefly look at the judgment of the CFI, now the General Court, the First Instance Court. The First Instance Court adopted a very much monist approach to international law. So what it said was that the UN Security Council resolutions take primacy over EU law. Therefore, we cannot use EU standards of fundamental rights to review the UN Security Council resolutions or any measures that follow from those resolutions, unless, and this is quite a controversial caveat, unless there is a breach of jus cogens, in other words, the peremptory norms of international law, in the Security Council resolutions or their implementation. So in other words, the European Court of First Instance held that it was bound by Article 103 of the UN Charter, which says that UN law takes primacy, takes precedence over all other types of law. So you can very much categorise the CFI's judgment, the General Court's judgment in Caddy, as approach three, their deferential approach, saying we are not going to review any measures that flow from or necessitated by the UN Security Council resolution because international law has primacy over EU law. And so Mr. Cadi's action would have failed according to them. Now, the ECJ did not agree with the CFI, with the General Court, and overturned that judgment, adopting a very much dualist approach to international law. So the ECJ was accepting that it did not have the competence to review UN Security Council resolutions itself, but it did have the competence to review implementing EU measures, in other words, the regulation in this instance, which Mr. Cadi was trying to review. And in particular, it had the competence to review implementing measures for compliance with the EU's fundamental rights norms. And so the question is, which approach does the court's judgment really represent? And again, there are different views on this. I'll state my view in a minute, but commentators have really varied between saying that this is maybe approach two, looking at the source of the measure. Is the source of the measure here really the EU rather than the UN? You could say that this is what the court's judgment is saying. Is it approach four? Is it saying, no, the EU legal order is supreme over the UN legal order within our little territory of the EU at least? Or is it approach five? Is it saying that for now we do not accept that the UN system offers a sufficient protection of human rights, but if it does so in the future, then we will respect that guarantee of human rights at UN level? And I think there is certainly some evidence for that last approach in the court's judgment, in my opinion anyway. So what did the ECJ's judgment really say? What were the core parts of its judgment? Well, I think these three statements are really important and worth looking at from the judgment. So really what the ECJ was focusing on was the critical importance of fundamental rights for the EU's legal order. So it said, fundamental rights form an integral part of the general principles of law, observance the court ensures. Respect for human rights is a condition of the lawfulness of community acts. Measures incompatible with respect for human rights are not acceptable in the community. And its conclusion, again quite controversial, the obligations imposed by an international agreement cannot have the effect of prejudicing the constitutional principles of the EC Treaty, which include the principle that all community acts must respect fundamental rights. So even if obligations were being posed by an international agreement, which in principle might be seen as being higher in the hierarchy of norms, that can't compromise this constitutional commitment to fundamental rights within the EU legal order. So the big question, is this challenging the primacy of international law? Well, the ECJ did consider this issue in quite a lot of depth, and it was really a very carefully nuanced judgment that the judges would have taken a long time over. And the ECJ says, no, this is not challenging the primacy of international law for a number of reasons. Well, the first is the one we've just said. They're not actually reviewing the Security Council resolution, they're reviewing the implementing regulation. Now, if you say that the regulation really doesn't allow any discretion for the EU in implementation, that argument really isn't a fantastic one in terms of really convincing that it's not challenging the primacy of international law. So nonetheless, it did state that to start with. The ECJ very much affirmed that the EU had an obligation to respect international law in the exercise of its powers, and this is long-running case law from the ECJ. And it specifically referred to the special importance of UN Security Council resolutions and the special importance of UN law and the Security Council. However, it made two really critical points. Firstly, the UN Security Council resolution did not require any specific mode of implementation of the resolution in domestic or regional legal orders. In other words, it was open to the EU to implement the resolution any way it wanted, more or less, as long as it achieved the aims of the resolution. And its second point was based on what we've just heard about the crucial nature of fundamental rights to the EU legal order. It was not within the court's jurisdiction, nor in the jurisdiction of the EU institutions, to authorise what would effectively be a derogation from the constitutional fundamental rights principles of the EU. So that was what the EU ECJ said in relation to the primacy of international law. So now, I'm about to finish off here, so how we really analysed CADI, and how I think you can still analyse it, is that the ECJ was trying via CADI to send out two really distinct messages, and I would call them the internal message, the message to the EU's internal legal order, but also an external message to the world more broadly. So let's look at what certainly we argued was CADI's internal message. And really you can see CADI as the ECJ really being brave enough to say we are going to act very much as a constitutional actor and decide which values are most important in the EU's legal order and decide whether or not there is a hierarchy of values and where we place rights, fundamental rights, in relation to security as a value. And the ECJ was very adamant that it was not afraid to do this. So you could see this, if you look at it from the EU lawyer's perspective, you can really see this as another step in the court's kind of courage to go beyond being a purely economic constitutionalist court, which is where the EU all started, you know, looking at kind of more or less economic issues, going beyond that to now being very much focused on fundamental rights and social protection and citizens' rights. And we have it also in the EU's citizenship ECJ's citizenship case, and we have a similar trend here. So I would certainly argue that this fits with that trend, and it shows that the ECJ is really wanting to show that it is competent to decide that fundamental rights is the ultimate value in the EU's constitution, even though we don't call it an EU constitution because that was rejected in 2005. Still, it sees the ECJ, it sees the EU treaties very much as a constitution, and the CADI case is in line with that. So why does it take this very strong approach and constitutionalizing role internally? Well, you can really see it as part of a dialogue with national courts and with national constitutional courts in particular. We've spoken about the Solange jurisprudence and similar cases from the German Constitutional Court, for instance, where the German Constitutional Court has very much emphasized the need for the EU to have its own strong human rights doctrine, and other national courts like the French court and in particular the Polish courts now, the newly acceded Polish courts, have also emphasised similar things. So you can say that in part CADI is really a reassurance to those courts that yes, fundamental rights are absolutely crucial in the EU's legal order. So this is a message of reassurance to them. However, if you wanted to look at it the other way, you could say that perhaps a national court like the German Constitutional Court could say, well then, if you, ECJ, are undertaking this rights review of a higher international norm, then why can't we do the same for reviewing with EU law, with German fundamental rights norms? So, and we see this kind of tendency in the Lisbon judgment of the German Constitutional Court, where actually the German Constitutional Court relied on CADI, relied on the ECJ's judgment of in CADI to similar effect. In that case, the court ultimately did not go so far to say as the EU's system, that this EU system of fundamental rights didn't comply with the German fundamental rights norms. But nonetheless, there was that little threat there in the judgment, which was quite interesting. So in other words, national courts can say, well, if you can do it, then why can't we do it as well, you know? Why can't we undertake review for fundamental rights with fundamental rights as well? Okay, so what about the external message then? This is the one that I think most commentators outside the EU have focused on for for natural reasons, really. And again, we have very critical comments coming from some commentators. Gráinne de Bhurcaigh is an obvious one who argues that really what the ECJ did in Cádiz represents a complete failure of the ECJ to engage in this dialogue on the relationship between international and European law. And she says that Cádiz is very much a case about pluralism in international law and rejecting this constitutionalist approach to international law. And she argues that it's very much in line with the US Supreme Court's judgment in Magellan, the one we've just discussed, as does Posner and Goldsmith. And essentially they argue that Cádiz represents EU isolationism that the US has been accused of for many years. The EU is effectively just as bad with Cádiz and is rejecting international law. We don't agree with that at all. We certainly see Cádiz as really affirming this, if you want to call it a constitutionalist commitment, but specifically to human rights as a value that should be absolutely respected, not only in the EU legal order, but also in the international legal order. And if you look at the court's judgment, it very much says that respect for human rights is also a fundamental part of the UN Charter and the UN's hierarchy of norms and the values that are in the UN Charter. It's not picking out the EU's values as being any way different to the UN's values, but it is applying the EU's values nonetheless in this particular case. So we argue that it's really this commitment to this shared values and fundamental rights that the Cádiz case is trying to get at, and they're trying to send out that message of the commitment to fundamental rights, international and regional level, in the judgment. So what happened after Cádiz, just to bring us a little bit up to date? Well, Cádiz was informed by the Sanctions Committee of the reasons why he was listed, and he was given the right to make comments at EU level to the EU Commission. Nonetheless, he was kept on the blacklist, okay? So that led to a follow-on case, which we'll discuss in a minute. At UN level, we've seen quite a few changes as a result. Well, you certainly, strongly, arguably, as a direct result of the Cádiz judgment of the ECJ. So in particular, the Office of the Ombudsman was created at UN level. The Ombudsman's role, it's an ombudswoman at the moment, actually, a Canadian woman. Her role is to hear representations of individuals who find themselves placed on the blacklist. Nonetheless, it is the Sanctions Committee, and solely the Sanctions Committee, that still takes the decision as to whether or not the individual remains on the blacklist or not. And that decision is taken by consensus by the Sanctions Committee. So although this ombudsperson exists, she really doesn't have many powers at all, and has been strongly criticised, position has been strongly criticised for that purpose. At EU level, the 2002 regulation that Cádiz had challenged was amended to specifically require the Commission to provide this statement of reasons, which they must get from the Sanctions Committee, because of course the European Commission has no idea why the person is being placed on the list. And the Commission is obliged to review its decision to include the person in the annex to the regulation in light of the observations submitted by that person. And we've had a number of cases, the Othman case, the Ayadi case, the Hassan case, where essentially the EU courts have implemented Cádiz, again, in the context of different individuals. That's Mr. Othman there, perhaps not his best photo ever taken, but he certainly got some happiness from implementation of the Cádiz judgment. So Cádiz 2, September 2010, the General Court was asked to give a ruling on whether or not the statement of reasons that was provided to Mr. Cádiz following the process we've just spoken of, whether that was adequate. And Mr. Cádiz was arguing that he had no way of knowing what the evidence on which those reasons the evidence was for the reasons that he was given. And if you look at the statement of reasons that was provided for in the UN Sanctions Committee website and also in the General Court's judgment, they're fairly sparse, yeah? They simply say Mr. Kadi was involved in heading up a charity, and the charity was then suspected of being connected with terrorist funds, and that he hired various other people who then in turn were being suspected of being involved in terrorist activities, including Mr. Ayadi, who's brought another case, the one we spoke about. So essentially what Mr. Kadi was saying was that there's no way that he can effectively rebut those reasons, because he has no idea of the evidence that led to the conclusion that this meant he was involved in terrorist activity. The General Court's judgment is really interesting because the General Court is being pretty cheeky about the ECJ, which is the higher court, in its judgment. It is obliged, obviously, by, you know, the hierarchy of courts to follow the ECJ's Kadi judgment, Kadi 1 judgment. Nonetheless, it is pretty clear that it doesn't agree with what the ECJ said in Kadi 1. I've just given an extract there, you know, where it says certain doubts have been voiced in legal circles as to whether the judgment of the ECJ is consistent with international law and EC and EU treaties. You know, it doesn't need to include that in the judgment if it doesn't want to. It's very clear that it's doing that because it doesn't agree with the reasoning. Nonetheless, because it's bound by the ECJ judgment, it does go on to exercise a full review, as the ECJ's judgment requires, over the decision not to give further evidence of Kadi's listing. And in that case, again, it holds that if you look at this from a full review perspective, you have to come to the conclusion that there's a breach of Kadi's rights here, because there was no evidence provided at all to Kadi to justify why he was on the list. So the reasons weren't enough, effectively. There was no effort to balance the need to respect the confidentiality of national secrets and of international secrets and rights, on the other hand. So again, the whole thing has been sent back to the political actors to try and come up with an answer to that one. All right, so very quickly then, some conclusions. Certainly, I see Kadi as being very much the ECJ wanting to engage in this inter-institutional and interjudicial dialogue, not only with national courts, so its internal message, but also with courts outside the EU's jurisdiction as such, including the Strasbourg courts, but also more broadly at UN level with the Security Council process as such. And we see that happening with the creation of the Ombudsman Office. I see it as offering this real commitment to the constitutionalisation of rights at international level, and this very much a focus on rights at an internal level within the EU member states, and more broadly the ECJ being really willing to act as a constitutionalist actor in the sense of balancing values and deciding that rights are at the number one place in the hierarchy of values within the EU. And again, it may be a good headline, I would argue, to say that it's rejection of international law, but I think that the court's judgment is just far too nuanced for that really to hold up. So that's all I have to say. So now I'm very interested to hear what you have to say, Rob.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here. Thanks very much to Pierre.